This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 29 for Thursday, October 15th, 2009. The Men Who Knew Too Much.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Good evening, all you little dogies out there. We're sitting around the campfire, and the principal is gone. John is on vacation, so we're glad to be here. And I've got some panelists to introduce you to. Mr. Jim Hall, the man I affectionately refer to as the man who knows too much. Jim, how you doing?
I'm good, Peter. Thanks for having me here.
Glad to have you here. We have Mr. Rod Maloney here from our local NBC affiliate, WDIV. Rod, how are you?
I am well, Peter. Thank you very much for having me. This is my first go-round in the rodeo here.
We're thrilled to have you. And I don't want you viewers to be alarmed. We have two gentlemen with ties on, but it's just an aberration. And Mr. Frank Marcus from Motor Trend, the technical director for Motor Trend, welcome.
Thank you. Also a newbie. I'll be the loud one, podcasters.
Their ties are really bothering me, though.
It has martini glasses on it.
Well, that's excellent.
I want a martini.
So let's see. Another hellacious week in the land of automobiles. Since we're going to talk about the wide-open news of the week, I think Rod, who specializes in covering the business on the business side, what's your take on this week's events? What do you want to bring up tonight?
Well, I think that the Ford UAW contract, which is what I spent much of the week on, felt that was a very interesting dynamic. Of course, I get the phone calls from the UAW guys who are telling me that the union's not so happy with the way this went because essentially they said that they felt that the Ford management, with Gettelfinger's blessing, sort of went around to the locals and sold the package, and that they're not everybody's on board.
It's a poison pill at the UAW.
That's why I was surprised to hear that. But my phone is jumping off of my my ears. These people are screaming about it, but I think that in the end, Gettelfinger's attitude is: look, we've got to get them to parity, or we're going to have a problem. And so they, whether he rammed it down their throats or they all sort of acknowledged that it had to be done, it is now done. And I did reflect this, and John was kind enough to allow me to come sit in for him this week. And I truly believe this is sort of a fulcrum moment in the automotive industry in the history, because it's, in my estimation, it's put up or shut up time. You either make it or you don't. You got everything laid out for you. You have every opportunity to turn a gargantuan profit here. The estimates are now saying that the level of break-even point is now about 2 million vehicles, less than it was just a couple of years ago. If you can't make it now, you're not going to make it ever. So
that's a 2 million breakout for really GM, that number.
Okay. Yeah.
And you find that Ford's a tad under that, although in some aspects they're a tad over, because they still are carrying more debt.
Right.
Than the other guys. And Chrysler is appreciably below that.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's time for them to break out. And it's either put up or shut up. And I even said, I'm tired of hearing about foreign exchange rates, UAW contracts, the debt load and everything else. Just build the cars, make them great, and sell them. If you can't do it, get out. It's time to really shake the thing out for real.
Well, and the other in that long roster of excuses, we should mention sunspots, because that's always been.
Right. And I think they're worried that there is going to be an outburst of sunspots that could take out critical communications sap.
No, I think this Ford thing is significant because, Ford does have momentum. I mean, the recall aside, they have some serious momentum. And now that they're on the level playing field, watch out.
There's one other thing, though, that burdens all of the domestics that doesn't burden the transplants, because they have younger and smaller workforces, and that is healthcare costs are still part of this. They are in this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And while they can address other issues of the union contract, that one is still there, and that's the gift that keeps on taking. We just have to be aware of it. That is an anti-competitive issue. The system we have is anti-competitive to businesses.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so we have to find a way to come up with a more competitive system, right. But that's still going to be there.
And Gettelfinger, when I asked him about the VEBA, was admitted openly that he's nervous, and rightfully so, because the IPOs will be coming out next year for GM and Chrysler, but nobody knows what they're going to be worth. They're talking about putting billions of shares out there. If I'm Ron Gettelfinger, I'm very nervous about the way that's going to go, no doubt about it.
Well, there's one other piece of news, but before I get to that, I'd like to say hello to Scotty in Cleveland. You're the man. You thought I was going to forget about it, but I didn't. How you doing, man? Frank, what do you think about Bob Lutz's CTSV challenge?
Well, you know, I mean, it seems to be fostering a pissing match between, you know, some of the blogging sites and so forth.
Yeah.
I like his chances in the CTSV.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially since those guys were fighting over who got to bring, an XKR, XFR. My money's on the CTSV all day long.
They're going to have to modify the Dickens out of that XFR to do that.
Forget about it.
They won't allow it.
I know that. Well, they could be running it on maybe Vindaloo instead of gasoline.
You know, it's funny. I got the chance to interview Bob about this and talk to him about it. And I looked him in the eye. I said, Bob, I got to hand it to you. You are having more fun than any five people around us. And he said, well, isn't that the point?
Yeah.
You know, and I think in the end, he is really having fun doing what he's doing. I think he's that confident in the cars, that confident certainly in the CTSV, that he can go out there and just have a great time. And he knows we'll all follow along. We'll all be watching. We'll see if he can drive the damn car and take it from there.
Is anyone bringing an M5 that we know of yet?
I'm sure
a little more concerned about that.
But is the Pan Am qualify?
Oh, no problem. It'd beat that.
Well, I don't know.
The
turbo is a different kettle of fish than the things we've driven. It is.
I don't think it really qualifies, though.
What's the criteria?
It's not a four-door, right?
Yeah, it is a four-door.
Oh, it is a four-door. Okay.
It's a four-door with actually a roomier rear seat for four than
for Vendelin.
Well, yeah.
He demanded.
He has the tall torso.
In case your viewers out there want to know why the Pan Am looks the way it does, Vendelin Wiedeking said, I have to sit in back. What is he, 6'2", 3?
6'2", and he's actually tall torso. So
It
did take the D-line in the car and carried it a lot farther back than they wanted to.
He said, I have to be able to fit in that car, and the designers probably weeped for a
And meanwhile, human-scale guys like me are sitting down kind of barely looking over the gunnels, you know?
Yeah. I think the CTSV is going to win this. I don't care. And if it's not Heinrichi driving, it's going to be Jan Magnussen from the Corvette team or Olivier Beretta from the Corvette team. And believe me, there ain't anybody who's going to beat those guys.
Isn't it Lutz driving?
It doesn't have to be.
If you watch it, here's how they put it.
Scrutinize the fine print.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they say an assigned, a pro driver or appointed designee.
And, of course, you know that the GM launched the CTSV there and have had some sort of cooperative agreement with Monticello Motorsport Park. So those guys have probably got a lot of laps there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they do.
And nobody else does. So,
whoever shows up better have a pro driver. Otherwise, they're
If somebody thinks, I can do this, they are going to be... the best part of it is the lap of the gods that Heinrichi did at the Nürburgring is with the car in sport mode, and he didn't shift it at all. It was an automatic.
That's the way to do it.
I know.
Yeah.
And that's what Lutz said he was going to do. Now, Lutz told me he was driving, and he said if he loses or if it looks like he's going to lose, then he'll give it to somebody else. But that he was going to drive it, it was going to be automatic, and he was going to learn to tap the shifter at the right time.
We don't have to. Yeah. You put it in sport mode, and you do the stability track and competition mode. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, that car, it's looking at things like it's looking at steering wheel position, it's looking at yaw rates and so on, and it knows what gear you need
and
to be in.
That, but Cadillac invented that performance algorithm shift thing way back when. They're still the best at it. Nobody
Absolutely.
Has got one better than theirs at figuring out what gear it should be in.
Actually,
when.
The Audi algorithm is getting very close.
Yeah.
It is, but it ain't there yet.
Yeah.
Because every time I get out of a CTSV, it's like, yeah, I could live with this. Although the new general manager killed the color I would want to order it in, you know.
What color?
Diamond blue. He killed the... Mr. Nesbitt doesn't like the color. A lot of people don't like the color, and so it's like, kill it. So they got rid of the color.
I like the diamond blue.
I did, too. So, you know.
Send them back to design staff. I'd rather have them complain than make those kind of decisions, damn it. So how about the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, weaving his way into Detroit, Rod. Did you want to help our viewers out with what
he
did?
You know, besides he came and he visited. He visited everything and, you know, declared everything hunky-dory. And
He said Detroit is back.
And mission accomplished.
Like, excuse me? What?
Walked in. I for the life of me can't understand how 3 months ago when they were showing the same product, it was not good and now it is.
No, he's talking about Dan Aykroyd, Dr. Detroit, from the movie of the same name. Dr. Detroit is back. Yeah. They are going to make a sequel.
Yeah.
Jude Law is going to be Dr. Detroit anyway.
Going ahead and just declaring victory, you know, that's all it is. I was heartened that I didn't have to go follow him around, because when you go to these events, it's like it's the ultimate yawner, because you've been through everything he's looking at.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do anything. He's just it's a camera up. And I'm sorry, but I don't think Ray LaHood knows any more about what's going on in the design dome.
No,
Ford
he
truck sitting on the counter.
You know, I appreciate the fact that it's a word of encouragement from someone in Washington. You know, it's better than, you know, you guys suck and you're going to suck forever.
But they've taken responsibility for it. Now they're in charge.
Peter, the thing he should have said is, I think Detroit's back. He should have made it a comment from the Secretary of Transportation. Mm-hmm. I've seen this stuff, and I'm convinced.
Or they're going in the right direction.
Yeah, but I mean, to declare, I mean, that's mission accomplished, okay?
Yeah, and then to say that Sergio Marchionne is the next Diet Coke, I mean, come on.
I don't know. That one, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt there, because I do want to see Sergio do the buy a check and check it out commercials. I mean, I do. I do. I want to see it. You know, you get this check.
Okay. So, yeah, that was kind of chaotic with Mr. LaHood here. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I actually did work at Chrysler when Lee Iacocca came whooshing in.
And I worked with
I
Lee.
Think he was really talking about, talking to the employees.
Yeah.
They had the feeling like, ooh, this is just like Iacocca. You know, we've got a guy who knows what he's doing and he's gung-ho and, you know, we're, you know.
Stop and think about it. Chrysler management, from the acquisition by Daimler, was there ever anybody there that actually whipped people up because it looked like they had a vision of what they were going to do?
No.
There was no vision under Daimler. You know, now, admittedly, they were doing those cars under Dieter Zetsche, who's a car guy.
I will say that Wolfgang Bernhard fired up the engineers.
Yes, he did fire up the engineers. He did. And the purchasing people, too. He actually did.
Yeah.
But the point is, weren't not so much.
but generally, the whole company wasn't sitting here going, yay. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened when the three-headed dog owned it, same thing. There was not anybody there they could look at that was just going to say, look.
And everyone was sort of smarting, you know. This great company that was just our own little company, now are, you know, lap dogs of somebody else and whatever. And I think there was kind of a malaise, you know, that permeated. And we got the same general, you know, situation now, but I think maybe they do think, you know, these guys are better.
There's a huge philosophical difference, though, between the acquisition and having Fiat in the equation. Fiat needs Chrysler. Mm-hmm. From an absolute standpoint, because Sergio and some other guys believe they've got this magic number they've got to get to maintain critical mass purchasing through the next decade, and that number's 5 million units. Now, you look at it and you say you can probably build it to that and do it, but that's the only way they could have done it. There's no other way.
Well, and you know, Daimler and Cerberus, they put a lot of money in. How much did Fiat pay for Chrysler?
They get paid to take it off their hands.
So maybe that's a whole different ballgame. They're like, man, we got this free car coming. Let's go for it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and from what I'm getting, and my phone's been ringing off the hook about Chrysler, I called Jim about this because at one point, a couple of weeks back, they were contemplating bringing the Pacifica back.
Yeah.
And I'm going, okay, well, let's figure this out. Come to find out, they couldn't even do the project because they didn't have enough people to figure out whether they could even get the thing back into production or not.
They found out the tooling for the rear suspension was scrapped.
Yeah, it was gone. And so it was like, and so it's, huh, you know, you get these kinds of calls. Now I'm hearing, I bumped into a buddy of mine the other night who was one of their engineers, and he goes, you got to hand it to these guys. They are bold. He says, they're putting a top hat on everything. And they said, if it goes, we're going to fly. And if it craters, it's going to go up in a conflagration. It's just going to be. And so they're all sort of wondering what they're doing. And now they're saying what they're doing is they're hiring like crazy.
Yeah.
Because they got rid of so many people. They just have an insatiable need for new people. And so maybe some of GM's old people were going to end up over there. Because you can't go back if you've gotten the buyout.
But it takes forever to get people up to speed under those conditions.
You're absolutely right.
And,
yeah.
You know, and every time Sergio makes a pronouncement, I just say, you know, don't make a pronouncement. Because we're hearing all this. We're in this town. We know there are websites with lists of hire engineers that they need, and it's just like they're not able to get the work done.
Right.
No. So that's, you know, it's just.
Well, you know, I would.
And people blast me, you're too negative on Chrysler. I want Chrysler to thrive. I really do. But boy, when you know what's going on there, it's just like, right. Man, they are.
Chrysler's biggest problem is this product drought that they have. And right. How are they going to bridge that?
Yeah.
And how much are they going to commit to turn it fast at the end? The hi-hats are interesting. But doing a hi-hat on the GS platform, to me, is really a case of good money after bad. Because that's a platform that was a hand-me-down to begin with. It wasn't what Chrysler wanted. And they ended up having to do it. And that's the thing that has given us the astonishingly beautiful Sebring and the Havenger.
God, it's horrible. So the latest word is Dodge truck is going to stay, but Dodge car is going to evaporate, and there will only be Chrysler cars.
That's the rumor.
And you pointed out a problem with that.
It's long-term strategy. 10 years, that could be a viable thing to do. But in the near term, they started tooling for the new Charger. And that's a car that's going to be defining the passenger car side of Chrysler for a long time. So, you turn it off, and you can turn off the tooling. You can do that. And then what you have to do is say, the incrementality of adding these cars would give us this much revenue. It'll cost us this much to cancel it. Where are we upside, downside, long term? And I think they're going to have to stick with it for a while. But it's interesting.
Good looking, too.
It's beyond good looking. It's a Charger.
Yeah.
You know, this is a car worthy of Gale.
So it'll be harder to do like they did when they canceled Eagle. We'll make a 300 out of the, you know. It'll be harder to work that in as a Chrysler because.
I don't think they can do it. Yeah. Plus, you know, you have Dodge now. The Dodge passenger car stuff, in a way, is defined by the cars they have that people still like. So in a way, you can say Dodge is defined by a retro car, but defined by the Challenger, which isn't halfway bad, you know. Mm-hmm. So you start looking at it, and it's like, where's the net add by making everything a Chrysler? I think the reason they're looking at it is that the strangeness of what do you do in the midsize market with Chrysler and Dodge, because they're a single dealer outlet.
Yeah.
And if you have these two cars next to each other, as they do now, it raises some real questions.
Yeah. They just seem to be careening from one fire to the next. Mm-hmm. And every time they come up with a plan, you know, the last plan, and he got fired, was, oh, Chrysler's going to be like a premium. It's just like, yeah, okay.
Chrysler's going to be above Cadillac.
Yeah, okay, maybe 7, okay. 8, 10 years down the road.
15, 20.
Yeah.
Cadillac ain't there yet.
No, and Cadillac's been at it for 10 years.
Right. This is a 20-year thing to do it with credibility.
Yeah, and Cadillac's just starting to get there. Mm-hmm. Just starting. And so when I hear those pronouncements, that's why I'm negative on Chrysler.
I would like to jump in here on the notion that Marchionne's been too, you know, openly, you know, ecstatic and saying silly things. I have yet to even see the man in person, okay? And I work the beat, okay?
He wears nice suits.
I'm sure he does. Actually, he wears sweaters, as I understand it. But my point is this. I haven't had a chance to interview the guy. Haven't had a chance to ask him one question. He hasn't made himself available. The only thing I know about him is his office isn't in the tower. It's over by the engineers because right. He wants to be near them. Well, I'd like to get a chance to ask a couple of questions and really get a feel for what he's going to do. Now, they're going to have their news conference on the 4th of November announcing their program, and I'm thinking, well, why am I going to this? I know everything that's in there already. Give us a chance.
Actually,
to,
you don't.
Well, okay, all right.
They're going to be
most
of it. There are one or two little surprises.
Okay. Well, I'd like to see a surprise, but I'd also like to hear from him personally and you know, get a measure of him and trying to figure out if is he blowing smoke or is he really as audacious as the claims are.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of hyperbole involved.
All I can say is we know he is not Carlos Ghosn.
No, he is not.
That is a very good thing.
And that's a good transition, Jim, because the next thing...
You are so smart.
The next thing we need to talk about is Carlos has, in case anyone's missed this, he has a hyper-aggressive all-in play on full electric vehicles for Nissan that is shocking. And people... Thanks. Jim, you know, that's great. He claims that pure electric vehicles will capture 10% of the global market by 2020. I mean...
There is a certain logic to it. Let me explain why, if you're a manufacturer.
Well, there is a certain logic to it.
And part of it is the cost of certification, of emission certification, to a corporation is it's eye-watering on a global basis. You do an EV or a car that's categorized as, because it turns out, extended range electrics, the Europeans are looking at them different from the States, and they may actually, there may be a benefit even more to do those in Europe. But the point is that a pure electric, you have no certification you have to worry about. The only thing you have to test for is evaporative emissions. And in this case, we're talking about oil in the lubricating system and basically the washer fluid, because they do shed testing for that, and it makes a difference. So you're talking about a product that would be, from a cost standpoint, zero emissions.
Well, I get that.
And the thing is, but that's why, that's the golden ring. And I have a feeling that Carlos and some other companies are laboring under the delusion if they push harder, they will accelerate battery development. And to that, I can only remind you, there are three kinds of liars in this world. There are liars, there are damned liars, and there are battery engineers. Because no matter what you do with battery technology, it isn't the kind of thing that develops on a linear basis.
No, and you know, I'm with you on that one, and people keep saying, well, but you know, we're in the infancy of these things, and once these things take off, and I say, hey, wait a minute, for several decades here, we've had the space program, right? I mean, there's no plugging in. There's batteries up there. They get a little solar over here and there. With NASA budgets, they didn't get, too much further than what we are now.
No, they have. They have. Bipolar sodium sulfur batteries that are used in a lot of satellites are astonishingly powerful batteries. They really are.
Okay. I bet you they're cost effective, too.
That's what I love. Sodium bipolar battery, about this long, about this big around, when you put it in its thermal enclosure, it needs, because the sodium and the sulfur must be liquid in the battery. See a problem here for the car already?
Yeah, see, I mean...
But in space, first of all, the dealer is a long ways away for those satellites. Okay, it is. but it's an absurdist philosophy to think that battery technology, because you want them, will develop faster.
I'm not so sure that there won't be 10% in Europe, because I kind of buy the notion everything's so close together around there that it'll get to a point where the family has one electric car and one go-on-vacation car. And so if every household had,
Well, I can see that for the U.S. in 2040.
Right. Maybe. Agreed. No, 2040, I would agree. There's another thing with...
Everyone says we need a 10x drop in the price of the batteries. I mean, Vinod Khosla, the known, venture capitalist, has very little or no money, I think, in the long range.
Yeah.
And he's saying, if we're all worried about, because I saw him at this Going Green West conference I was at, where we're all, any way to save the planet, this is great. He's like, you got China and India growing in these ridiculous amounts. They can't afford any batteries, in India especially. So, I mean, if you really want to fix the global, if you can get the IC engine, consumption down in half, and he says that's a lot easier. He's got four or five different projects working on that and none in batteries.
We've all said the development of the IC.
It ain't over.
And it's got a long way to go.
Totally.
30, 40, 50 more efficiency.
Now, its place in what it does in the car is going to change, but so what? It changed before. Think about the Benz Motorwagen. Mm-hmm. That was an IC engine, kind of. But the thing that gets me with batteries and advanced battery development is when you look at, one, where does the material come from for batteries? Lithium. Where's the big country for lithium now? Bolivia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they have to develop an infrastructure and a facility. They have to develop mining capabilities, and it's going to necessitate capital they don't have. So somebody has to come in as the battery godfather to do this. And,
it's a slightly lefty government down there that's...
But you could say the same thing about China. The governments come and go.
Yeah.
They do. But batteries are constant.
The other thing, the rare earth metals. Now, I heard about this plan to restart
mine in California.
Out in Colorado or whatever. Yeah.
Colorado company is going back into a mine in California that's allegedly got more than China's even dreamed about.
I'd be sort of surprised about it. Maybe it does. But yeah, right now, it's 90% or something like that is coming from China, and they're talking about, turning off the tap on the exports of that stuff. And then what?
But you see, the Earth is willing to give up its treasure of battery technology. I'm sorry. I love the concept of electric vehicles. And if you think about it, when Ghosn is saying, we're going to do this, and his company is headquartered in France, which has a massive nuclear power scheme that actually gives them excess generating capacity.
Right.
Yeah. There's some countries that if you tried to put 10% of the vehicle population as electrics in as a substitution, even over a 5 or a 10 year period, you would be heavily burdening the electrical generation capacity of that country.
Presuming that they have to be plugged in during the daytime.
You've got to charge them somehow.
Right. But if they're charged overnight, pretty much everyone says, you know, the overnight hours are always,
Definitely. But the point is, you still have to have the capacity, the generating capacity, one way or another. And, you know, the idea of, okay, we're going to do 10%, but by the way, we have to build 3 power plants.
Yeah.
The equation looks kind of funky there.
Well, people forget what's involved in this whole electric car thing. And, boy, Carlos has bet the farm on it.
And he's, you know, what is it, like $1 billion they're putting into the development of the Better Place deal, the swappable battery.
Oh,
there's another one that I just don't think
Just a nightmare.
I mean, stop and think about it. If we all were to take the batteries out of our cell phones here.
Oh.
My guess is we would have no 2 common batteries.
No, absolutely
right?
not.
And the battery in here is cheaper. It has the potential to be more modular.
Yeah. Yeah, the packaging requirements aren't that dissimilar from all of our phones.
Right.
Think about a car. Yeah, I mean, and I think it was until very recently there were 3 different standards for the plugs in Europe to plug in an electric car.
Yes.
They were going to standardize everything it takes. That just seems like a non-starter to me.
So anyway, down the road, when we are in shiny Happyville with our shiny, happy, smiley electric cars, the next big challenge we have...
The carnage on the highways.
Well, because they don't make noise. Now, a few years ago, I attempted to get the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation off the ground, which was going to run electric vehicles at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Right, fuel cell, right?
Fuel cell vehicles. And part of the regulations that I had for the manufacturers, which they all loved, was each manufacturer had to have a sound signature that they would design for their vehicles. And that sound signature could be generated on board or be part of the wind rushing over the car. But each manufacturer had to have a sound signature. Well, guess what everyone's working on right now? Sound signatures for their electric vehicles. Now,
Lucasfilm is involved in this.
Yeah, Henrik Fisker, who I refer to as the P.T. Barnum of the auto world, claims his Karma is going to sound like a cross between a Starship and a Formula One car.
Okay, and now, see, what Starship? Because I have my favorite Starships that make good noises. And they're those ones that make that horrible noise in space that can induce diarrhea.
Well, the bad guys in Star Wars, they had a bad, they were the evil sound.
They did, but the TIE fighters, they sounded great.
Yeah, they sounded cool.
Screaming.
But anyway, he's going to have the sound pumped through the bumpers. And I actually think this is pretty cool. And down the road, I mean, what would your car sound like, Jim?
My car, that's
I'm going to ask each
one. Can you make it with your...
my car would sound like basically the land cars in Blade Runner, which would be like high-pitched variable gear whine, sort of, you know.
Okay. What about you, Ron?
A Fender Stratocaster.
How about you?
A V16.
Really?
I want a retro sound.
You know what's interesting?
Calliope on steroids for your ice cream fantasy truck. Cell phone ringtones.
Oh, there you go.
The Jetson.
You're right. Fired.
Meet George Jetson.
I don't know. I think I would have a little dial in mine, and it would go between a 7-liter Can-Am, big black Chevrolet, and a Matra Formula One car.
The one that hits C-sharp?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Gurney's Eagle Westlake V12. Those would be my 3 faves.
I'd put another thing in there. An Alpha 8C 2900C with a compressor.
You're going to be downloading your car tones just like you do.
But you know what? That's cool.
Tones. Yeah, sure.
What's interesting is Lotus at one time, when there was a lot of development in the late 80s and early 90s on things to cancel sound in cars. And Lotus had a very aggressive sound cancellation program that they were a system they were trying to sell to a bunch of car companies.
Wasn't GM involved in that?
GM was. GM owned Lotus at the time.
Yeah.
They built a Citroen AX, and they took the noise cancellation a step further, and it was basically a noise synthesizer that was tied to the throttle position sensor and so on. And it was in this Citroen AX. I drove the car. It had a manual transmission, and it was with a dymo tape thing, a little varactor, and it said 4, 6, 8, and 12. And you turned it, and it was sort of the ambient sound of a car with a 4-cylinder, 6-cylinder inside the car when you drove it. And it was interesting because same car, if you put it on 12 or 8, you drove the car harder just to hear the sound. And it wasn't obtrusive.
So but you got authentic 8 and 12 cylinder jack mileage.
Yes, of course, if you drove it that way. But it was an interesting concept, because this was happening in Europe when the noise regulations were threatening to make everything just silent in Europe. Ferrari was panicking, and they thought this was a saleable technology. Ironically, now, do it with an underhood speaker or something. You could do it for electric vehicles
Well, the reason this discussion is on the front burner all of a sudden is it's people in Washington.
And state of California.
They're starting to make noise about this. By the way, Frank, would your 16 be an auto union?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
I was going to say.
Open pipes.
Because it couldn't be the mystery 917 that Donahue ran because it
no
didn't
one,
make any noise.
Yeah.
With the twin turbos.
Yeah.
All right. Well, here's an interesting thing. This is be fun, I think. What are your most significant production cars of the first 10 years of the century? Production cars. What are your faves? And I'm going to throw out mine, just not all, but just surprisingly enough for my readers and viewers, I would say the Toyota Prius is one of them. The Corvette ZR1, because I think it's the high water mark in General Motors history, and the CTS-V. Okay, Frank?
You know, I thought about that long and hard, and I thought, maybe I just so recently did the most significant of the last century, and it doesn't seem like they're very significant yet.
Production cars.
Yeah, I mean, the original Honda Insight. You know, extreme lightweighting, extreme, fuel economy, et cetera, that would certainly be in there. I wrote down the Honda Ridgeline. I mean, for ludicrous, we're Japanese, we're going to make a truck. By God, it's not going to be like anyone else's truck. No one will buy it, but it was, an interesting...
Sales proof.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but an interesting idea and, a lot of innovation in there and so forth.
I'm going to be boring here because I'm not necessarily the product guy, as Jim will attest to. But yeah. I think the Malibu, the current edition and the one that's coming, is significant from where I sit because of what it says about General Motors. I think it's a game changer for General Motors in terms of, yes, we can. It's a great car. It's comfortable. It's got a good interior. We can sell it in large quantity for a very good price, and less than something. It's competitive with a Toyota or a Honda, and they can sell it for that price. For me, that's a real turning point for that company. I think the new Taurus does much of the same thing for Ford at this point.
What about you?
There are two that automatically rise up to the top. One of them, for other parts of the world, would have been at the absolute end of the last decade, but for the States, they started coming in 2000. It's the original Audi TT. Because from a design statement, that thing made a statement, and it had stuff that had been copied afterwards by everybody, the wheel orientation and so on, the surface philosophy. It was a radical car, and I think in a lot of ways that was, from a design standpoint, maybe the purest statement of the first decade. And the other one is a car that is the most absurd automobile in the world. It is the first 1,000-horsepower road car and probably the last one. And it's the Bugatti Veyron. And it's because it is an Alfa Omega in one thing. And those poles, to me, are very obvious cars. There's some others, but those are the ones, when you think about it, from a design standpoint, whether you like it or not, the TT was a real statement. And then the Veyron, because I would sandpaper my eyeballs to have one.
You might need one. I don't think they're that good looking. Anyway, GTR, you got to throw that one in there, too.
Yeah.
Partly because, it does...
Although I don't like looking at it.
It makes heroic power... And it's a little bit cynical, too, because it says, hey, you know what? People only utilize the acceleration from 0 to 120. Let's focus on that.
Because as soon as it gets low, it's
a supercar to 120, and then there's nothing left, which is, it's very interesting. It's a technological, tour de force with all the stuff that's going on in that car. So that's definitely in there, too. I'd put the Hyundai Genesis on as well, for... And actually, the two of them sort of separately. I mean, the first one came in and said, all right, we're not kidding. Just like, you remember Lexus back in the, 89 or whatever, that's us now. And yet it came out and the suspension was kind of, and then just 6 or 8 months later, the coupe, and suddenly you go, wow, this suspension's actually got it kind of down, so.
Yeah, if we're going to go down the road of talking about designs, that's a whole other thing.
Right, it is. But the thing is, the TT was such a design statement exclusively, because let's face it, it was a Golf GTI.
Yeah, but, it was such a Freeman Thomas is one of my favorites.
Remember the end of Singing in the Rain?
Not offhand.
But. No, with Lena Lamont singing.
Yeah, yeah.
And behind the curtain is Debbie Reynolds.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that one later.
No, I know where you're going. You go ahead and tell our viewers where you're going.
Freeman did a great sketch, but there's no doubt that a lot of the TT came from the people that were working in the Simi Valley Remote Project.
Right.
It really was.
Right.
And he was the guy in charge, but the truth is, you know, it's a classic example. Modern design comes from multiple people.
Right. The thing I like about Freeman is at least he will hang his ass out.
Oh, absolutely. First. Yeah, and you know, Freeman in a way is like one of those little wind-up robots, and it keeps hitting the wall until it turns and goes someplace else. And as long as the people that are employing him know when to turn him, they can get fabulous work out of him.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you liked it or not, the Ford Airstream as a concept was a spectacular idea.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they were never going to do anything with it, but it was one of those things that from a design standpoint, you looked at it and said, there is a design statement. And Ford knew what to do with it. For a lot of companies, that would have been a sketch or an idea, and it never would have gone any further.
Well, Freeman's in a great place right now.
I agree.
He's absolutely... For our viewers, he's helping Ford on their advanced stuff.
Yep.
He doesn't have to get involved in the day-to-day stuff, which is a waste for him. And so it's worked out well.
Yeah. And he's done great stuff. And he's done great stuff. I mean, whether you liked it or not, the infamous Hemi Super 8.
Oh, I love the Hemi Super 8.
Okay, but that was one of those cars that I loved it in a way because it was so polarizing.
Yeah.
It was also the car when I realized...
That was the influence for, you know, the Magnum and Charger and everything else.
But that was the car that made me realize the design world has changed so radically because when I was growing up, cars are supposed to be influenced by race cars.
There's the Airstream.
Yes.
That thing is just awesome.
That is cool.
When I was growing up, cars were influenced by aircraft or race cars.
Right.
And apparently in the 40s, they were influenced by streamlined trains and so on. So they've always had this outside influence. When I saw the Hemi Super 8, there was something that Freeman did on that car that so twisted the idea of what influences automotive design, and it was so wrong. Electronics. IMAX. Everybody remember the transparent IMAX?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the transparent plastic they did on the side of the Hemi Super 8? The light. It was using things the way electronics did, and it was like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. It's like, my God, it's cars influenced by cell phones and laptops.
Well, the nails on the chalkboard thing with me was the reverse A-pillar, which Chrysler never did. You know,
no.
It was a GM thing.
So like, it was. You're right. Chrysler never did do that. And you remember the nickname for those?
Knee knockers.
Like that, because when you got out of the car, since they brought the A-pillar back, they had to do this dog leg. And you get out of the car and swing your leg, and you would apparently just nail.
Well, you could do that in the Chryslers, too, but it was vertical instead of backwards.
You can do that today on the new 370Z on the edge of the doors.
The 370Z, there is a vehicle that I will say, I'll be polite and say it's an extremely troubled design.
Yes, but the door edges are enough to, you know, you got to be careful. Mm. There's the...
The Hemi Super 8.
Yeah. I love it.
It's spectacular.
It was visionary.
That is a great car.
To me, that's when Freeman's...
Yeah, I agree.
Unparalleled. I mean,
but there's a classic example of a company that did not know what to do with them, and it was after... I mean, and these strakes on the side, the three strakes on the side were actually translucent blue-green plastic. Wow.
But haven't they sort of taken that today? I mean, I think we're going to be talking commercials here, and the whole transition of the car as the... computer, the iPod, the cell phone, or whatever, and this may have been the sort
unfortunately,
of the
they sort of extrapolated the Sebring out of that car, which is really
in all of but they didn't make it work, you know.
No.
Boy, the Sebring just
oh.
And you
but
know,
it has
the original
the new...
advertising on that one said, you know, talk about how beautiful it was.
Thought, oh man.
Oh man.
Well, but beauty is subjective. I'll be the first person to say that.
Yeah.
And it is tough to do a car that. A lot of people look at, the majority of people look at and go, oh my gosh. But it's been done. I mean, and think about it. General Motors, for a while, had the ugliest passenger vehicle built in North America with the Aztec.
Yeah.
And then the Aztec went out of production, and then the Saturn Ion took that over for a while.
We should point out something about the Aztec, and it was...
Spectacular concept.
Absolutely.
No
spectacular
argument.
Spectacular concept, and we're seeing it every day. The BMW X6.
Correct.
The new Honda... Cross Tour,
sort of.
But the Aztec as a packaging design was absolutely brilliant.
Well, the people who owned them loved them.
Functional. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. But the point is, it's the classic example of design management losing the song, because they had this sketch, and the early sketches, it was called the Recon Project, and it was spectacular. And the concept was good, but the concept was already reined in.
Well, it wasn't based on any existing platform.
It wasn't, but they had already started to rein it in because the sketches were even more amazing. There was a vehicle full-size mock-up that predated it called the Bear Claw that was pretty spectacular. Yeah, there's the concept. And this was watered down compared to some of the other stuff. Before, it had much more form on the side of it. The problem was that design management couldn't get past the sketch. So no matter what they did to the car, in their minds they kept seeing the sketch.
Yeah.
And the problem is that they were given the edict, you have to use these hard points from the minivan if you're going to build it. And as soon as they did that, should have gone back and said, either recook the design philosophy for the package or back off the program.
Yeah.
And
I'll never forget that unveiling at the auto show. And I'm looking at it, and the front was a little odd, but they had so encumbered it with stuff that you really couldn't see the back end of the car, and so you as soon as they took it off, as soon as you saw one with it off, I went because it was that ugly. Didn't know that at the show.
Yeah, but they were way ahead of the curve on the whole package.
Because I contend that was in some ways the first crossover.
It was the first crossover.
Absolutely, yep.
Absolutely. And you know, it's unfortunate. But I just, the other day I saw one that was absolutely immaculate, and it was yellow.
Mm-hmm. See, I saw an immaculate copper one, a Rally monochrome.
Mm-hmm. I mean, someone who actually, this was well maintained
and
spruced up and perfectly clean, and was just like, wow, I'm a true believer.
You know, this scares me, the idea that one of these could be at Pebble in 2074.
Ooh. You just never know.
No. it was a case of strictly limited production by popular demand.
Demand limited, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some... everyone mentions that as the horrendous design statement of this recent times. Is there anything else that comes?
Well, I still contend the Saturn Ion was an astonishingly incompetently integrated car from a design standpoint.
It was really bad.
Ghastly. And in some ways, you can see a little bit of Ion in the Sebring.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. And it's interesting because then GM passed the baton to Chrysler, and Chrysler took it over with first, I think, the Compass. The Compass is this thing that looks like a diabolical cross between somebody got on a telephone and described a Jeep via the phone, and they were making it out of marshmallows.
sketch artist is on the other end. Yeah.
Exactly. And they got the Compass. So it just didn't, you know.
I wrote my column this week about how bad car advertising is. And, you know, I spent 22 years in the business, so, and I know you guys didn't, but I know you watch advertising, and I know you know that car advertising right now is pretty bad. GM is trying to reinvent itself right now with this competitive advertising. But I think for our readers, I want, if you think the ultimate driving machine came from BMW's ad agency originally, we're going to run this Pontiac GTO spot from 1967. I want you guys to take a look at this. Ben, can you run that for us?
This is the great one, the ultimate driving machine. And if you don't know what that means, you're excused. But if, when you see this car, you're seized with an uncontrollable urge to plant yourself behind the wheel and head for the wide open spaces, then we're talking to you. The great one is an idea on wheels. The idea that there's more to driving than just moving from place to place in isolated indifference. The great one is 400 cubic inches of glistening engine. The great one is a superb road handling chassis. The great one is bucket seats, carpeting, and a walnut-styled instrument panel. The great one is Pontiac GTO for 1967. Isn't it time you decided to ride the wide track winning streak?
Now, other than the last line, which
the great one is here,
brings me down. I mean, there is such attitude with that. I mean, today's advertising is so vanilla.
Well, a lot of it makes excuses for what they're selling.
Or, you know, my point in my column was they have to get away from the deal, and you have to get you got to get juiced up to get excited about these cars, because there's some great cars in the advertising not doing its job. And one of my longtime readers, Jack Jason from Black Rock, Connecticut, nailed it. He said, I read this just the other day, and after 30 years of pushing iron, he used to sell cars through the dealership doors. It's stuck. You can lead a horse to water, but how can you make it drink? Today's marketers want to educate the horse, have it know all about the benefits of water. That ain't their job. How do you make the horse drink? Make the bastard thirsty. That's what marketing is supposed to do. Are there any car ads today that do that? I can't think of one, and I'm dying of thirst. And he really nailed it. I mean, you have to have advertising that compels you.
Remember why the deal
draws you in.
Remember why we got into this position. First of all, that it got to the point where you'd have an ad budget when you're launching a car, and some of it had to be national advertising to position the car. But if you didn't have a price, you didn't have an ad. So they were doing it where they'd stick it on the end of the car driving down the wetted down road until finally you couldn't do launch advertising in the traditional sense. You had to do price advertising. It's one of the things that kneecapped the G6 from the start. They launched a car with a new name that they really needed to position. It was the highest volume Pontiac. Yeah. They launched it in the most competitive midsize market at the time. And all that anybody cared about at the dealer level, we got to have the deal. Tell us the price. And they never were able to position the car.
Yeah, well, it's just the short story is advertising is so bad right now. There's no emotion. There's no compelling reason to draw you in.
Can I jump in here? Because working in the television business, I think I have an understanding of where we are trying to make what we do interesting to people. The thing that is the problem right now is generationally, we're not compatible. Guys like us love that GTO commercial. I can tell you right now, my oldest daughter in college would look at that and go, what? They don't view a car the way we view a car. And so trying to sell a car to that generation, which is the growth generation for the car companies, has got to be entirely different.
Yeah, Rod, you bring up a good point. Ben, run the Nissan Cube spot for your daughter.
Oh, that's right. Mobile device.
I have to say, I like the car, and this commercial fits perfectly with it. Now, I think I'm going to ask John if we can have a whole show devoted to advertising. But that, you know, of the recent stuff, that's pretty good. It captures what that car is, and it kind of draws you in, and it draws that age group in.
The thing that I find staggering about that commercial is, unlike anything we are used to or want to see, that car doesn't move.
Well, yeah,
the set moves under the car. The wheels don't turn.
That's the visual hook in it. Yeah.
Well, but the visual hook, it means something. The visual hook is saying the kids don't care how that car rolls. They want to know what it does inside when they get in it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's extremely important.
There's something, there are these weird sort of social norms that happen. If you were to go to a party in the 50s, and you'd find that the women and the men at the party had separated into two different groups, and the women are talking about whatever they talked about back then, probably things like the president and what Mrs. Kennedy was wearing, and the guys were talking about women, sports, and cars. And when they talk about cars, you know what they were talking about. It's like more displacement, mine's more powerful, it's faster. You go to the same party in the early 90s, or late 90s, early 21st century, and the groups are separated, and the guys are talking about sports, women, and computers. And the stuff they're talking about with computers is, gee, you know, I've got a higher capacity hard drive. It's faster. They're talking about them the way that people talked about cars. There was a time when going to where you were going was the event. The trip was the event. Now it's where you go, and how you get there is becoming secondary.
Okay, well, I think we ought to just cancel the rest of this show. Cancel it.
Let's talk about computers.
We're all done here.
Well, no, but the thing is,
I get it, but, yeah. I think today's automotive advertisers got to get people.
I think the advertising has helped cultivate that lack of interest in cars.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I still say the kids don't care.
Well,
I think that most of the young kids I talk to are not interested necessarily in passion for cars.
Well, and that's what the Japanese manufacturers are extremely worried about. In Japan, because they're seeing that and they're wondering where this is going. I still think the concept of the freedom of personal mobility
right.
will always be there, and it always strikes someone at, you know, whatever age it strikes you, mm-hmm. that this concept of personal mobility still makes however we get around to be vital for years to come.
I've always contended, though, that since about 1924, the number of really car enthusiasts is a constant, regardless of the population. Because back then, if you owned a car, you had to be an enthusiast. And now, people are enthusiastic about the automotive lifestyle and stuff around it. But the people that are the serious car junkies, there seem to be fewer and fewer of us. There aren't. There's the same number, but there are more people that aren't.
Yeah. Ben, you want to run the rapid fire little graphic? We have the questions now that we've successfully killed the automobile business once and for all.
No, it's not dead. It's just wounded. You were
bleeding.
Shot in the head. It's the fleshy part of the head.
Well, why don't we? Can we do the phone call from Roaster Jack, the official coffee of AutoExtremist.com? He's up in Traverse City, and he's got a question about McLarens and Ferrari. Go ahead.
By the way, there is a spectacular configurator at Ferrari.com for the 458.
Okay, here it is.
Hey, guys, this is Roaster Jack calling from Traverse City, Michigan, with a question for Autoline After Hours. Given what you know and the option, that is, which car would you prefer, the McLaren MP412 or the Ferrari Italia 458? Thanks a bunch. Love watching the show.
That's an easy one. It is. That's an easy one.
Go ahead.
458. Hands down. It's more the pedigree is there. It's the first Ferrari of recent times that's modern, and it isn't slathered with carbon fiber where you don't want it in the interior. It's a real Ferrari. And the other thing is, I want more information on the engine in the McLaren. They're talking around it.
What would you say?
I'm with Jim. I mean, McLaren's got a ways to go to make everyone turn their head and look at that car. They know what to do and what to think of the Ferrari. Right?
I like the fact McLaren is doing everything in-house. I like where they're going.
I wish them a lot of luck getting there.
Yeah, yep. And if anyone can do it, they can probably do it. But the 458 Italia, oh my God, that thing is just...
The 458 is to me, it's Ferrari reassuming the position it should have. Now, the irony is it's probably the last mid-engine 8-cylinder Ferrari.
Oh, God, don't say that.
But it is. I mean, they've said, you know, that the 12s are probably going to become 10s, and the 8s are probably going to become 6s. They'll be positively, or they'll be supercharged or turbocharged, but CO2 is demanding it. You know, the thing is, I was thinking about the S-curve. The strangeness of the S-curve in our CAFE standards. And I realized that the car that the S-curve is actually trying to get the manufacturers to build is a 3-cylinder Crown Vic.
All right, let's get to some of these comments. Doug Stokes, corporate publicist, Gale Banks. Hey, Frank, thanks for the kind words on that Banks breathed on Jetta DTI. We appreciate it.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, fun stuff.
So what was that?
I was at the, Bosch's the Drive to 35.5 event.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's close to what a TDI Cup car is running in the race series.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's a six-gun thing and, you know, breathe on air, you know, better airflow, et cetera.
Okay. Here's a comment from Jeremy Jones. Any thoughts on the new 4Runner? No. Okay, next question.
Coming soon.
Pedro Fernandez asks, would any of you bet your farm that Chrysler will survive? Number two, with all these GM execs quitting and being replaced, is it hurting the company image or helping it in the public perception? Three, can you please ask GM ad people to stop referring to GMC as professional grade? It's quite childish. Okay. Would any of you bet the farm that Chrysler will survive? Rod?
No.
Yes, but the definition of survival, it may be a very, very different company than we imagine it to be, but yes.
Fiat North America.
Very possibly, yeah. But a survived company.
Okay, Frank.
You know, the eternal optimist in me has me with Jim here. Long term, surely there'll be some sort of a Chrysler.
Yeah. I want to just jump in and by saying no. Just watching the condition they're in is bad. I drive Chrysler, so I don't want anybody thinking that I'm wishing them ill. I have skin in the game.
Yeah,
I'd rather they survive.
Appreciate phenomenally if they want
yeah.
The other thing is about GMC, professional grade. At least now the badge on the back doesn't say GMC truck. Remember when they badged them GMC truck like you didn't know?
Yeah. They might want to put that on the terrain. I don't know.
Asian Martin asks, Asian Martin's a regular viewer. Anybody else notice that the Buick LaCrosse and Regal will overlap each other? What's up with that? And which would you keep? Every time GM takes...
I don't think they're going to overlap.
I don't think they will either.
Yeah.
But, you know, every time GM takes two steps forward, they're taking three back. I mean...
They're different sized vehicles.
I know, but I'll switch gears. I'm talking about the Equinox and the Terrain. Do they really need both?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you know why. I mean, if you look at how GMC works, the incrementality, it gets some numbers they couldn't get the other way. And the median transaction prices on GMCs are higher than Chevys. You know, one of the last divisions they should throw away is GMC because it is cash.
Well, that's the only that was the first division that the government overlords wanted to kill.
I know.
Right? And then as soon as they saw the numbers, they said, okay, right. We won't suggest that.
Can I jump in and just we kind of glossed over the GM executive question. I think Mark Lenev, great guy, but he clearly had to go. I mean, John Stewart made fun of him terribly on his show. But by having a woman now as the head of sales, I think that image-wise is hugely helpful. The notion that they're jettisoning some of these older executives it helps with the government's case that we are changing this company, and they do need to do that. And so clearly I think it's helpful.
As long as they don't start bringing soap people in.
Well, that's true.
I mean, we saw what the soap people
could
do at General Motors. And
yes.
There's some of the people that, you know, you think about it, the whole adventure of brand management and of the smale time is one of the reasons that GM went on the rocks when it did.
True.
If that did not happen, if Eddie Munster was not made the chairman of the company, and if they kept Stemple in there, mm-hmm. it would be a different company now.
Well, I put it in my book, the John Smale era was the most damaging to General Motors.
You could almost feel that. When you'd go to an event with him, you could almost feel it in the room. Like, this guy is sort of an interloper, and it's not so much that we don't need some new blood around here, but this guy's just not right. This is not right. We're not.
Yeah, that was a case where they weren't giving him blood. It was actually turpentine.
Yeah.
Now, why is the patient responding the way he is? Ah!
Here's a good thing, comment from Neil. Regarding design statements, he missed the criteria. We didn't have any criteria, Neil. We were just talking. The Corvair Lingers is one of my all-time styling and engineering favorites, which brings to mind, I was 10 years old at the time, but what was the impetus to develop domestic compacts at that time?
Oh, simple. First, I agree with him on the Corvair. It was an astonishingly influential design. It influenced front-engine rear-drive cars.
I had a 69 Corvair, and I ordered my J.C. Whitney headers from J.C. Whitney, and it was...
Second best Corvair built. Best, of course, would be a 66 Corsa. You know. Anyway, but the reason that the compacts happened when they did was the increased penetration of compacts and Volkswagen Beetles, Renault Dauphines. It was those exciting cars and a myriad of strange BMC and Roots products. So the domestics thought, well, we need to do a small car to get the business. And
George Romney started the domestic.
Yes, he did, by taking the old Nash Rambler and reskinning it and turning it into the Rambler American. But that happened, and then on top of it, there was that little thing where the economy went into the tank in 58 that made everybody that was working on their small cars realize this was the right thing to do. And General Motors looked at the car that was the biggest seller, they looked at the Beetle, and they said, we're going to do that, but do it better.
Okay. Well, you know, this has gone by too fast, but we're at the end of our allotted time period. So I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. I want to thank Jim and Rod and Frank. I really appreciate it. And John, we didn't blow it up real good while you were gone, but we tried. You can follow Frank's work at MotorTrend.com and at Twitter.com/MT_
Yeah.
Marcus. You can see Rod at ClickOnDetroit.com. Mm-hmm. And, of course, WDIV Channel 4 here in Detroit, which is our favorite local station by a mile.
Thank you.
And, Jim, is there any place we can track you down?
Oh, every now and then I appear on Facebook in one of my many guises.
Okay.
Sometime, Mr. Let Me Use My Real Name.
Okay. You can visit my website, autoextremist.com, of course, or follow me at twitter.com/autoextremist, although I rarely appear there, much to the disgust of the
Twitteroids.
And, of course, you can follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. And don't forget, you can also friend us on Facebook to get all kinds of content throughout the week. You can find our page at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit. And thanks to everyone out there joining us live. So that does it. Another session around the campfire.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.